Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Annie Lindstrom. I am the host of Talkupy. Welcome to the show. We are a show about people who do good things for community and make the world a better place. It is raw, live radio, so there's some stumblings and bumblings sometimes, but we do our best we can. So bear with us if there's any kind of technical difficulties, just hang on. And if we seem to be bumping into each other, I can't see my guests and they can't see me. So we just do the best we can to get in our flow as soon as we can. And we appreciate your patience. Please visit talkupy.net to find my blog, videos, photos, and show notes and archives of more than, I think we have 137 shows right now. Also, you can follow the show on Twitter at Talkupy_radio. I had the other one. I had the one without the underscore, but I forgot the password. So, but it's still mine. So there you go. Anyway, as far as shows go, looking back, let's just point you back to last week's show with Janet Donahue about Don't Frack Southern Illinois. That was an awesome show. I enjoyed learning a lot about where my alma mater is located and what it's dodged, what kind of bullets it's dodged and what kind of bullets it hasn't dodged. Very good show, technically speaking, about a lot of the things that are going on in people's ideas about when things are over and when they're not over. Also, we visited with Robin Mello last week of Philadelphia Orchard Project, and previous guest who was on the show when she was with Occupy Vacant Lots. And we caught up with Robin, and it was wonderful. As usual, Robin's doing just amazing things in Philly. And we're actually talking to Philly this morning, too. So that'll be shortly. Also, do want to look back also to the show with Aaron Califato, who does a show, a one-man monologue show called For Profit, about for-profit higher education institutions. That's really awesome. He's great, and he's just a great guy to listen to because he's a monologuist. So great person to have on the show. Love these performers coming on the show. Need to get some more. Make note of that. Also, you can click on the contact tab at talkupy.net to send me any listener mail, any kind of feedback. Love getting your feedback. Write in with comments or suggestions for future guests. I usually cultivate the guests, but I really wanted to get this show to be more collaborative. So I'm hoping that people will feel free to chime in and help out in that respect. This week, just in special notes section today, we've got, want to remind you that on Thursday we have Mercy Junction Justice and Peace Center. We have Beth Foster, who is also returning to the show after she used to work in Cleveland, Tennessee with Animal Rescue, and now she is a co-director of the Mercy Junction Justice and Peace Center, and she'll be on Thursday as a brand new endeavor, and it's certainly neat. They're having, I guess, a funeral procession this week for people who are uninsured, which is going to be kind of neat down there. Not that, you know, just symbolically, of course. Also want to give a shout out to everybody in Oakland who went to Oakland this weekend for the big climate march on the West Coast. It looked awesome. Damian Lozo, former guest, is posting a lot of things about that, and he was super pleased with it. So I'm sure it was just awesome. Apparently it was even bigger than New York, which doesn't surprise me. Also, before we begin, I want to thank Ronald Jenkes for his song Disorganized Fun, which is a Talkupy theme song. Check him out at ronaldjenkes.com. Ronald doesn't sponsor the show, but I pay him that tribute for letting me use his song. Also, Earth Guardians are now closing out the show with their song Be the Change. So, Eat Squatley and Shuteska Martinez, We got to thank them a big bunch because that's a great show. At the end, it's always hits home. So now let me bring up Jimmy Betts. Let me see if I can get him on here. There we go. Jimmy, this is Jimmy Betts, and he is a life artist and joining our show this morning from Philadelphia. How are you doing, Jimmy?
I'm doing great, Annie. Thanks for having me on this morning.
It's my pleasure. And this is a show, another show helped kind of co-produced by John Zangas, a former guest of DC Media Group. He suggested that Jimmy take a chance and come on and talk to me. So I'm grateful, very grateful to John, as usual, and everybody at DC Media Group for just doing all the great things that they do. Jimmy is pretty much a big picture guy. We're going to see that as we talk to him. He says he's living in great simplicity and fighting for ecological justice on a planetary scale. And, you know, that's a big thing to say. But and you also believe that he also believes that all the movements are connected. So but I want to really explore some of those topics with you this morning, Jimmy, as we get into it. But why don't you introduce yourself to everybody? Tell us what your journey was to kind of to the climate movement.
Oh, okay, sure. Well, I was let's see how far back we want to go, but I was raised in Omaha, Nebraska, and let's go back a little bit further than that. I was actually adopted as an infant from South Korea, so I was raised in Omaha, Nebraska, by my parents now. And from that point on, I certainly had an interesting upbringing in a predominantly African American community, and basically I was the minority in that community, being a Korean American at that point. But as I progressed through, as I grew up, I was able to see things from a different perspective, kind of from both sides or many sides, certainly not all sides. But as I did grow, I realized that there were certain inequalities and certain privileges that many people had that others didn't. And that sort of shaped my impressions of, I guess we'll call it, human rights and also natural rights, the rights of nature. As I did go through that process too, I became interested in martial arts and, more importantly, sort of the preservation of life through those practices. So it wasn't really about fighting and trophies for me. It was more about learning about myself and kind of helping other people, if they wanted it, have a more in-depth experience, you know.
Right. Well, let me ask you about the martial arts. When did that start, and what kind of martial arts did you get into?
Well, after great seeking, I guess, as a kid, all that was available was Taekwondo, which the interesting thing there is it's a traditional modern Korean martial art, and it really didn't stick with me. I was really disillusioned by people who were just competing and using it for trophies and making money off of families. But anyway, I won't get off on that tirade
right now. At
least you
didn't get enrolled in a dance program, because those are even more money grabbing.
You know, that's one thing too that I kind of regret. I kind of wish I had a little bit more dance experience. But
no,
again, there's time for that.
Back at that age. Okay, so you didn't like the Taekwondo, so.
No, and I was probably 6 or 7, so I was really anti martial arts at that point because of that experience. But in high school, I took it upon myself to find something that was more stimulating and holistic, and I found a great school in Omaha, Nebraska, called Dragon Arts, and they specialize in traditional healing and life arts, and specifically with the Chinese martial arts. So that would be Kung Fu and Tai Chi, to drop some more understood phrases and words out there to identify. But that's the system that I started with, and it, because of how my teacher taught, it allowed me to experience something very foundationally and then also build upon it without feeling as though, you know, it was a betrayal of student-teacher relationship. If anything, he's been extremely encouraging in my branching out, whether it's the experience of the application of practical martial arts to social justice movements, or whether it's actually going to see another martial arts master who may have something to share and contribute. So definitely another foundational experience for me that shapes how I operate now.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. I actually did Tai Chi in New York years ago when I lived there.
Oh, yeah,
I wasn't
great.
Very good at it, but and we watched, of course, when I was a kid, Kung Fu. I mean, that was the show of my whole life. That was like the biggest deal ever on TV.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, people don't realize how important that was. It was amazing. And my brothers all took judo. I tried to take judo, but I got too many bruises. So I had to quit. But that's cool.
Yeah,
so you got the martial
great.
So you got the martial arts thing going and in high school, and then so what happened after that?
So from there I went to college. I went to school for engineering in Iowa, and I was also a bit disillusioned by my prospects in the future as being, well, you'll probably be wealthy and probably privileged and probably oblivious to the rest of the world, because engineering, the program there at least, was so focused on getting that corporate job that I really lost interest within, you know, about 3 years. So it took a little while, but I transitioned out of that and ended up taking a plethora of courses that had nothing to do with engineering. And because of the stringent qualifications that are required of the engineering degrees, I could take pretty much whatever I wanted to at that point and still get a degree within about 4 years. So I did that, and throughout that period of time, I think I probably taught more martial arts and life arts related classes than I actually went to college, which was great. But again, there's that chronic maybe overworking going on there, but it was something that I wanted to do as opposed to something that I felt obligated to do for society or my parents, perhaps. But I'm glad that they encouraged me to get that degree, and I am glad I have it. But I don't know that I would want to do that ever again in that capacity. So,
wow.
But from there too, it sort of brought me into another level of organizing too. So starting out with organizing some community classes and growing them into, you know, 100-person or more seminars, and then eventually that took off into going on the road and teaching. So for maybe the past maybe 5 or 6 years, I've been basically mobile teaching in different places like Boulder and Austin, and it just really depends on where that desire is, because I'm not really one at this point to try and just overly market myself, which to set back, I eventually ended up getting a marketing degree from my university experience. So not engineering, computer or electrical engineering. It was marketing with an emphasis on Chinese and Spanish and entrepreneurial studies and psychology and sociology. So definitely took a broad spectrum approach to understanding the world in front of me, because college really doesn't do well to prepare students for the real world. It just isn't set up that way, unfortunately.
You think? I remember
it's
when
bad,
I was
but...
I just thought, wow, this is like a yes man factory. This is teaching you
follow
orders, you know. And I was the same way. I mean, I couldn't decide on a major, because I wanted to do anthropology, I wanted to do sociology, I wanted to do oceanography, I wanted to do everything.
Oh,
so basically, I ended up just saying, okay, I'm going to do English because I like to write. And if I can write and read about everything that I like, then I've got it in the bag. So that was my choice. And I think it kind of turned out well for me, that one decision anyway. Not that it ended up with
sure.
a good pay, ever like with a great paying, like super great paying job, but that's all right.
Sure.
I don't mind. I don't think I would have been a good rich person. I would have spent all my money. Any money I get, I basically spend. It's
yeah,
one of those
yeah.
things. I think they teach you that at college too.
Yeah. Well, to go into debt chronically, yes, that's definitely something at this point that is being taught a little bit more broadly, unfortunately.
Right. Well, they started with
yeah.
the credit cards at the credit cards in the student center back then when I was yep. there. I actually think that started, but that's too long ago. So you came out with the marketing, and now you do the mobile teaching of basically the martial arts, the Kung Fu and the Tai Chi.
Yes.
And
yep.
So how did you get to climate, though? Like, where did that come from?
Okay, well, I'll add in one more component there. I went back
yeah,
to school
ahead.
Again for specific massage therapy training. So really exceptional school in Omaha, Nebraska, called the Universal College of Healing Arts. And, again, another family that I consider very much family in my development over these past few years. And getting that approach to just being able to work directly with people in a medical, possibly spiritual capacity opened the floodgates to the holism that we're trying to address between ourselves, between people, as well as between humanity and the natural world, we'll say nature or natural reality. And once that started, I kind of had to adjust all of my trajectories to something beyond just teaching a few groups here and there and teaching just exclusively private lessons to people, and directed it towards what is one of the major issues of our time right now that will address our relationship with nature that will have, you know, ongoing positive benefits if we do it right over the next 100,000 years. And again, for me, that could be very optimistic, but I have to think about it in that terms at that point. So I was able to connect with a few groups along the way and just to kind of understand more about what was at hand and things related to the climate. And at the time it was just called global warming. You know, climate change wasn't really used. This is global warming. And
right.
Again, a misnomer in many ways, but it meant to illustrate a basic point, and mm-hmm. Being able to get people to understand how that affects them. It was sort of an awareness and education time, as opposed to just being an action time. So everybody has to go through those steps. And in that case, I was still doing my own thing, but being educated at the time. I was in my own ripening process.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain level, I actually enrolled back in school to get a degree for something that I already had training and skill in doing. I just needed to be certified and licensed to do it. So I very easily stepped out of that because, frankly, those programs will be there. You know, this opportunity to make some sort of social change strategically with a lot of people who are now coming into their own, that may not happen again in my time.
Right,
so I have
right.
to take this opportunity to do it. So I stepped out of that, and I found through some friends and contacts in Iowa, they're organizing a march across the country specifically related to the climate change issues before us. So
okay.
That's kind of where
let me sum up then. So you got your marketing degree, but then you decided that you would go to the Universal College of Healing Arts for the massage school, but you didn't get licensed as a massage therapist?
I did get licensed there. For the Chinese medicine specifically related to like acupuncture and those requirements, which is, you know, anywhere from 70 grand to 120 grand. And
yeah.
4 years in some cases, it's like I already had that training and that background to apply, but I couldn't
yeah.
do any of it outside of friends and family without risking arrest potentially.
Understood.
So, yeah.
Okay,
so
I just didn't get that. Yeah, so and plus you
yep.
get that degree, you've got to get an office and you're kind of nailed down, sort of. And this
yep.
is so interesting to me that there's these rich, great things that you're pointing out. Two of them in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places.
Oh,
where
yeah.
We had Art Tandrup on from Nailey a couple, and he was also invited by John. So maybe he has an affinity for people from Nebraska. but it's interesting how much richness there is out there, you know, and that area that people might not even think about. I remember driving through there on the way to Colorado just thinking how pretty it was to drive across the plains. And this was, you know, years and years ago. But that's great. So we're all learning something about all the richness and cool and wonderful things that are in Omaha besides insurance companies.
Oh, yeah.
But,
well, can't forget those.
No, you can't forget
yeah.
those. We could even get into that, but we'll just skip that. So basically,
yeah,
you heard about the climate march then. So this is recent then. So you just recently kind of got all this stuff wrapped up in a little bow there.
Okay. So, yeah, there's a huge distinction, I should say, between the People's Climate March and the climate march that walked for 8 months from Los Angeles to D.C.
Oh, okay.
So that,
okay, so this
that's
is the first one.
Distinction.
All right.
Yes, yes. The
might
one
know
that
you
started,
for that.
Yes. So that's what I was involved with well before 350 made their kind of announcement that,
mm-hmm.
hey, we're going to do a People's Climate March. So we were, I don't know if we were in New Mexico or Arizona at the time when that announcement came through, but we made arrangements to join that mobilization in New York City. So we had to shift around quite a bit of what we were doing to make it happen, but we did. but definitely the long-term 8-month approach to bringing awareness cross-country, which, again, it's an entirely different experience. You actually get to see the beauty and also kind of the horrors of what people have to live with that
Right.
we as a society have enabled to happen and have basically resigned them to live with without any real voice. So very disheartening in many cases, but also a great reminder as to what we do have still to protect. And it's not just
Right.
about landscape and environment. It's also about the richness of humanity, of people that are extremely resilient. But again, without support, us supporting each other, we'll never really make those steps forward together.
Exactly. And I've been reading a few things from some other people who are on that march as well. But basically, you guys started in California, and you walked the 3,000 miles across the country to D.C. from Los Angeles, right? And that was last year.
Yeah, it was.
Year. When did that start?
Yep,
you
had taken
8 months. 8 months.
Yep. March 1st to November 1st of 2014, and we actually started in a fairly low income, predominantly like a minority district in Los Angeles called Wilmington, and it was basically a cancer cluster, kind of a sacrifice zone in our, in our modern world. So walking through and walking with, it wasn't really about going on tour through this place. It was specifically about connecting with people who are fighting this every single day and have been for decades at this point without abatement, without any support, especially from the majority of movement, which is one thing that, it comes up more regularly now because it is an issue that needs to be addressed, is how the climate movement, how the ecological or environmental movement is structured. And it's primarily white, middle-class, privileged people who are taking the helm. And that's really not appropriate when you look at the broad spectrum in terms of both our country as well as the world. So the term, the global majority, has been applied to people of color, Asian and African American, for example, as being, again, globally, in fact, the global majority. So it's something that needs to be honored before we can actually take steps towards finding some sort of climate solutions. We can't just do this with one view, one perspective, or at least one cultural imperative.
Right. But then again, you get into the point where it's hard for sometimes people who are in disadvantaged areas to break away and do things like a climate march, so on and so forth. And so it's like it's a really bad, it's a spiral, downward spiral in a lot of cases. But we've seen a lot of things changed in the past year, at least especially with the shooting of Mike Brown and the reaction to that. That's really kind of just energized, the idea of getting, more equality into the movements as a whole. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It still
yes.
seems kind
yes.
of segregated to me, but I don't know. I'm not out there. I'm in the middle of, very not liberal Florida. It's hard. But it's funny. There's a lot of diversity here, right? Sometimes I go talk to the kids up at the 7-Eleven for a little while when I get a soda. And there's a lot of different people come in there that I didn't even know lived in my neighborhood, which is really amazing, because we're so walled off. We're so just walled off from each other. We don't even know who lives in our neighborhood. I mean, not in the suburbs like I live in, which isn't even really a suburb. It's kind of like it's a place where people live half the year and then they don't live half the year. And the rest of us sort of stay here the whole year and sweat it out.
Sure.
But it's really odd. I mean, I've noticed that there's a lot of diversity in my town that I didn't even realize just from hanging around at the store, which is really a weird thing to come to that kind of awareness. But on the climate march, I guess there was like 30 some of you, and everybody finished.
Mm-hmm.
What was the mix of that group?
So it really varied because some people would start out and then they already were scheduled to leave at a certain point. So folks were staggered in here and there. Some people who joined kind of very impromptu rejoined later because they couldn't stay away type thing. So it was definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely very enticing to get involved, especially once you'd already been in the process. And there's so many reasons for that. But, like you were saying, just going out to your local convenience store, being on foot and seeing people where they are and interacting with them on the same level, that's kind of one of the key factors in bridging movements. It's just simply having a conversation, having a dialogue that isn't about, I know it's better, or I know it's best.
Right.
We should really do what we're doing. It should be about that active participatory listening. It shouldn't be about laying down an agenda before somebody who may not have any ability to contribute to it, but now feels as though they have to because of somebody with privileges saying, this is how it should be. That's exactly why we're kind of in this situation to begin with, is that type of engagement process. So, but that was something that as we learned, as we walked across the country, we were able to realize and become more sensitive to communities that are basically in peril right now.
Yeah.
There's definitely a process that has to be gone through by those communities just to become more activated on their own, because after a while
right.
you get beaten down. You know, it has to be something where you can feel as though you're supported and uplifted by the greater whole, the greater good. And we did see a lot of that happening along the way, but we need to be able to encourage that in a real way beyond, you know, solidarity and liking on social media and just tweeting on Twitter, for example. So there has to be some real specific conversations happening.
Yeah, it seems like a big break, like it was thrown into the mix, you know, right at the right time, you know, you could say it's a, you know, kind of, well, then they just didn't Twitter and Facebook just pop up at the right time, you know, for
yeah,
the 1%.
Yeah, yeah.
But then again, you know, it's like it was sort of leading that way. Even TV, you know, you could, I mean, Aldous Huxley pointed that out, you know, pretty brilliantly at Ray Bradbury. But, you know, I think that the thing is, I just read a book because of one of my guests, Ronna Bazzini, who she walked against, you know, money in politics from Sarasota to Tallahassee. She happens to be 81 years old. Now, she is awesome. You would love her. But she told me she was inspired by a book written by a walk done by a lady named Granny D. And she walked across the United States. It took her 14 months in 1999. Mm-hmm. And she was 90. She was actually 89.
Wow.
And she finished the march when she was 90. And she pretty much followed the same routes that you guys did. And it was amazing. When I read the book, I was just sitting in the bed just going, man, I wish I had like a group to go share this with right now, because it she ran into every single issue along the way. You guys were marching for climate, but no doubt you ran into, you know, all the issues that tie everything together. And this was like, you know, 15 years ago. But she hit them all. And it was, and I mean, everything. No stone was left unturned. But she also had 100 years of a lifetime to reflect on and push back into the book. It's called Granny D, Walking Across America in My 90s. I highly, highly recommend it to anybody. You can Kindle it for about $7. And it's just brilliant. You know, and it really, I think, you know, it reflects a lot of what I'm sure you guys went through. And she would go through this place and that place. And she went, you know, she marched through West Virginia in a blizzard, you know, and dealt with all the, you know, the mountaintop removal issues and all that other stuff. So it was just like, it was fascinating, you know. I know that you guys saw a lot of stuff, especially in, you know, the southern Midwest. I mean, you've got like Louisiana, well, places in, you know, Louisiana that are just being completely developed for this aftermarket for the fracked gas and oil and all this stuff. You know, it all, once it comes out of the ground, it has to go somewhere, and it doesn't just go straight into a pipeline, but you know, and some of it just gets stored and processed and, you know, refined or all these other things. So there's a lot going on. I keep mentioning this article by Talia Buford. I got to put it up. I keep forgetting to get it before I get on the show, but it's just about what's happening in Louisiana with regard to that. But yeah, you should check that book out for sure. But can you relate like any story that like, can you remember anybody that you talked to that made an impression on you on the way between California and D.C.?
Well,
related to anything.
Well, plenty, but is there any specific area? It could be related to refinery districts or
one that touched you, something that just stood out for you, like someone that you just like were blown away by or really saddened by.
Oh, wow. Well, I know very, very specifically we were going through one of the pueblos in New Mexico. We were going through during a festival time where we had a gentleman walk up to us. We were eating a tamale from one of the vendors, and he invited us down to his house, which is a common thing. You know, people open their houses up and they have a huge feast going on in their homes. And I was with two other marchers, and I, you know, felt pretty safe accepting an invitation from an absolute stranger during a festival. So we ended up going down to this house and were able to sit with a family who's living again in a pueblo, sort of in a way it's a kind of a reservation, but basically all indigenous of New Mexico there. And just being able to sit with them and have conversations about the problems that they were experiencing. In particular, we were able to speak with the son of the person that invited us, and he became extremely emotional in expressing his despair. And he began by addressing sort of the president, President Obama, but eventually came around to and hit many, many intersectional points about whether it's water and air, or whether it's people mistreating one another, or whether it's the inequalities that we experience just every single day that we see as being just part of our society. This type of oppression, we're sort of, our society's kind of founded on that, and breaking free of that was definitely something that this young man was feeling. He was extremely expressive, very eloquent for his age too, and that definitely hit me very early on in the march. And this, New Mexico is, we'll say, about 2.5 or 3 months into the walk, so it was less than halfway through. So, and that changed my perspective going forward.
Oh, that's interesting. And but it was like under the umbrella of a festival, and you're hearing all this crazy,
the contrast is huge.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And so what about other things did you hear? I mean, so you heard about basically, you know, just prejudice and oppression. Did you run into clueless, like, privileged people? I'm not going to say white people, because there's privileged people everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, you know, in every class there are privileged, clueless people. But obviously we, you know, we might take the trophy for that.
That could be more accurate in saying that. In Arizona, and I'll just say this very broadly, Arizona, I experienced more of that mentality, sort of both oblivious, but also just apathy, just didn't care. I ran into a woman near, Sun City West, Arizona. And she explained to me very clearly that Arizona doesn't have water problems. There's not a water shortage. There's plenty of water underground that can always be tapped into and will never be exhausted. And she obviously doesn't understand how an aquifer works.
Right.
Also doesn't understand that other people, even down the road from her, probably don't have access to water. And it was just, in these cases, it's less about judging somebody in the moment and just sort of hearing where they are. And if there's a point for conversation where you think that there might be a time to educate or just inform, you'll take it. But otherwise, there was no dissuading this woman's opinion. It was just pretty amazing. This is outside of, it was near a Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
And I just remember the details because of how blind this person was in expressing how clearly they didn't have water problems in this part of the country.
Right.
It's just pretty amazing though. It was just, but that was one that stood out. That was just before we entered New Mexico as well. So very early on in March did we experience this full blown privilege.
Wow. And so how did you deal with it? Did you just listen and say, well, thanks for telling me how you feel? What did you do?
Well,
in
this case, it was just, I was sort of, in the back of my mind, it's like, I can't believe I'm hearing this, but I have to believe I'm hearing it because I'm hearing it. But after this woman got done talking about this, and she's, you know, she's standing there with her, she's sitting in her car with the air conditioner running. It's just, you know, idling next to me. And just waiting there, talking to me and trying to inform me about what's really going on in the world. Because, again, I'm younger and she's older, whatever. But my response is, well, you know, that aquifer that you're talking about, those wells that you're talking about getting down into, you know, they're at risk of being, you know, chronically depleted at this point. So there's more to it than that. She's like, well, that's not really what I've heard. I was like, well, It kind of also depends on where you're getting that information. It would be helpful to kind of see who's controlling that information, who's making money off of this water. It's like, oh, people don't make money off of water. And at that point, it's just sort
No.
of, I'm not going to get in depth on the economics of water rights at this point because there's just not enough time in the day for it. So,
Oh,
but it was
say.
very clear that he's been indoctrinated by people who have the control and the money. And I would say that the majority of Americans may fall victim to that, but at some point that fabric, that veil is wearing very thin, and there will be a
Right.
change that will happen whether we are kind of incited as a movement or whether it
Yeah.
happens organically with the support of a movement.
Yeah, that's interesting because I just heard a podcast this weekend about how it took forever before the US government stepped in and started doing screenings at airports. That hijackings, took place for years and years, before they wanted to, before they finally decided, hey, and I guess it was when the one hijacking that took place and took the guy to Lebanon or something like that. I think I've got the place wrong, but they had a picture of the hijacker with a gun to the pilot's head, and then everybody got upset. And then finally, after years of hijacking, like people were basically take us to Cuba and give us, billions of dollars and this and that, they finally decided to do something. So yeah, I mean the poo-poo eventually hits the fan. But the ignorance, the level of ignorance is, and I don't think, I don't know. Do you think that that's cross-cultural or do you think that's cross? I mean, how many people really, I think there's such a small stratification of people that look into anything further than the news, or if they do, they, and that they don't take, one website's, version of it. You know what I mean? They look for a pastiche of stuff to come up with an answer, that sifts out of all the things that you look at, good, from the weirdos to the good guys, So I mean, it seems like a small minority of people that are going to actually understand that there's an aquifer, or that they're in, neighboring New Mexico, there's, attempts to, I don't know if it's New Mexico or Utah or wherever they were trying to bury, they are going to bury all this depleted
Uranium.
radioactive stuff. Not just uranium, all radioactive stuff. Everything that's radioactive goes to this one place. It's going to go into some salt caverns or something, but they can't figure
Oh
out
gosh.
whether that's a good idea or not. I heard that one. I podcasted all weekend and I just heard the most amazing stories that you just don't even want to hear, But it's just like there's a lot of ravaging going on out there in the desert, which everybody regards as basically nothing, but it's really
Yeah,
something.
it's seen as a wasteland regardless, so we might as well just dump all of our junk there. But yeah, it just really depends on where you are. In the cases of being in the Southwest, it's sort of it'll be a wasteland. But if in the case of Seneca Lake, where there's a proposed salt cavern storage facility for liquid petroleum gas, they're using it as a storage depot. It's going to be something that isn't a waste. But in a manner of speaking, I would argue that it is in fact putting waste into the national ge natural geogra yeah geological formations up there. So. I know that at this point it's just sort of a matter of saying no and then being able to actually have people being taking predominance over corporations that are sort of exercising their dominion that's been granted them by us ultimately, but by our governments and by our legislation, which doesn't really work to honor people anymore, let alone the planet.
Well, speaking of Dominion, you had an action that you were in yesterday. I saw your picture
Oh
at the
the
Waldorf
yes.
Astoria. What was that all about? That was pretty ex that was outstanding. I mean, that was New York caliber protesting, if you could say so. But then we'll talk about whether it was effective or not, because it is New York. So what
So
happened?
there well, part of it there was a very specific reason that we were there, and that was to disrupt the analyst meeting for Dominion Resources, which is basically an energy monopoly, and it's a dirty energy monopoly primarily. It's oil and coal and natural gas out of Richmond, Virginia, is where they're headquartered. And because of how our energy economies are at the moment, because of the low price of oil, the shale gas bubble, which again it very much is an illusion that there's long-term prosperity in drilling for natural gas. In this case, it's fracked gas. It's very clearly fracked gas. To say anything else at this point would be silly. But there's a number of reasons why Dominion needs to be stopped in what they're doing. And part of that is to make people not invest further in something that's dirty, non-renewable, and certainly doesn't care about the planet or people that are affected by eminent domain or just direct pollution or the broader climate change that they're just exacerbating by pushing forward, in this case, natural gas projects, liquid natural gas export facilities across the planet, which, again, isn't looking out for energy independence because that's an absolute myth. It's baloney. It's just for corporate profit. It's something that needs to be stopped. It doesn't serve anybody but a corporate interest. So anyway, the action itself, there is an outside group that was, the theme was Star Wars, but it was specifically about the dark side because Dominion is part of or is very much an evil empire. There is no doubt about it. And what better figure to represent that than Darth Vader with a group of stormtroopers. So that was part of it. And there was an inside group that was attempting to infiltrate the meeting, but the security that was so thick because, again, like many evil empires, their armor is very thick and well paid, very well paid, to keep the people out of public process, or at least what should be a public process type of meeting. So it's very, very clear that they're trying to protect their own interests, and they also, I'm guessing, they know that they're in the wrong. There's a lot of commentary even from their CEO that leads me to believe that they know they're doing wrong, but they're going to do it anyway. So it's now time to escalate this process, and there are things in the works going forward. So we are just one part of this ongoing campaign of call it economic and environmental justice. Specifically, right now, Dominion, I'm part of a group supporting a group called We Are Cove Point, where there's one of these liquid natural gas export facilities that threatens immediately the lives of a community that wasn't represented in the initial proposal that was put forward from Dominion to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is FERC, which is basically the industries, the natural gas industry's rubber stamp of approval for pretty much getting whatever infrastructure projects, regardless of the environmental impact studies, which, again, at this point, if they were actually being done well, none of these things would be approved. But it's very clear that there's no oversight for them, and they're only supporting corporate interests. So that's another issue entirely there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let me point back to that if anybody wants to hear more about that. The show with Ted Glick that we did several months ago, you need to hear that. That'll catch you up on anything if you're interested in what FERC does. So, but it's just so good. Ted was amazing. Amazing.
Ted was with us yesterday, too. Yeah, Ted's exceptional.
It's just a phenomenal interview. I enjoyed that so much. So anyway, so you said that they put another town in there that wasn't on there to start with, and that was kind of weird that they did that, but they could do it, right? Because they want to.
Well, yeah, they can do whatever they'd like. You know, the misrepresentation of reality is something that corporations do very well. It means that they can do things uncontested. And when somebody raises the alarm about, well, you just said that only 5 people live here when there might be, you know, 10,000 people living here.
Right.
Because of the bureaucracy and because of how that system with FERC and corporations and our government is set up, there's no reason for them to be quick about correcting a mistake. And at this point, I don't believe they've ever pulled back a permit due to those types of concerns. And that's apparent. That's just something that I can't even get my head around. But I can, because I know now more through my own study and my own interactions that they're not out there to serve the people. They're not there to listen. They're there to put things in front of you to keep you busy so that they can build infrastructure that will basically dam our civilization and kill people. So it's all not very cheery, but that's kind of how they've put themselves into
exactly. Well, the one cool thing that happened, you had the mural in the teacher from Maryland. Her name was Carling. I can't remember her last name.
Yeah,
but,
Carling. Southern. Mm-hmm.
Carling Southern. Yeah, she climbed the 150-foot crane and dropped a banner. I was like reading. I was like,
oh, yeah.
Carling. Okay, that's cool. And then it said she, and I was like, yeah, girl power.
Oh,
man.
Yeah.
That was really awesome. But I mean, so you did the so she dropped the banner, and you know, you marched in front of the Waldorf with you know, a bunch of you know, Darth Vaders and the, what's the rest of them called?
Oh, the
stormtroopers. Yeah.
Yep.
You know, so how does this translate? How does this change things, or how does this work for you, and how does it actually make change happen? You know, because a lot of people now are starting to, you know, there's a lot of things coming up, you know, for people. They're saying, well, we've done this and done this for years now, and nothing's happening. I mean, do you just have to keep applying the pressure, or what's your viewpoint on that? I mean, as far as, you know, the efficacy of being in the streets and pushing that message, you know, from groups that are still predominantly unsegregated.
Sure. Well, and sometimes, depending on where these atrocities, these infrastructure projects may be built, if we're in this case, we'll just talk about it as an issue of infrastructure. In some cases, there may be a very homogeneous population, so it wouldn't necessarily be related to race demographic there. For example, if it was mainly a white suburb, which, hey, guess what? Generally speaking, infrastructure projects don't get approved through the white suburbs.
Right.
But just as an illustration there, that may be something that it wouldn't make sense to connect those pieces. But in terms of putting pressure on broadly, for example, through the efforts of SEED, which Carling is a member of Stopping Extraction and Exports Destruction, which is SEED, and they've been fighting this type of infrastructure for a while now, too. Many groups coming together, I think, at this point, that coalition building, also community building process, will result in a critical mass that will be able to exert a fair amount of social pressure that isn't just seen as some crazy person getting arrested on top of a crane. Because if that had happened by itself in a sea of nothing else, it would just get lost in that noise. But with things going on across the country, or at least across the region, Dominion investors or analysts meeting, multiple arrests at a construction company that is supporting or at least being contracted by Dominion to build this LNG project. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, different groups just addressing different aspects of this kind of octopus of empire that is Dominion, but it's also many different energy companies. This is just one area where we're putting pressure over time, and hopefully as things are escalating right now, it will be able to kind of wear into kind of their timetable first, but also possibly just making it less and less profitable depending on how the economics of energy are going globally. So there's a lot of different moving parts here that can be can be applied. And the difficult thing about the work that is being done, we don't necessarily know when that tipping point will occur, but if we don't push, then we'll never, ever know. At this point, my best gauge of it is the more people that are connected with one another and the more people can mobilize in an organized fashion that isn't about personal political gain, for example, which has been one of those ongoing things with activist-type movements, is that one person's ego will pretty much end it for the rest of the people fighting for something that is going to affect far more people than one's self-interest. It's being able to see that for what it is, call it out if it exists, and push forward. Right now, it's just that building phase. We're building our power in 2015.
Yeah, and it's like, it's things, you know, things that build, they get tore down and they get built up again, just like muscle, you know what I mean? It's like, that's how you build muscle. And I think that a lot of people lose sight of that, because you still hear these constant discussions of like, well, Occupy died, you know, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, wait a minute, my show is like from Occupy. Like, I know tons of people organizing over here and over there, you know, and that's what it's all about, is bringing everybody together. But I was telling you before the show that my lament is, you know, I have all these things that connect in a long string, you know, all these great interviews, but people will listen to the one person that they want to hear, and then they won't go back and listen to the other ones, and they miss that.
Sure.
You know, the like, we're just not a culture that thinks, we think about watching our program, you know, just like our grandparents and great grandparents said, well, I got to watch my program. You know what I mean? It's like you would never change the dial and watch something else or watch the Olympics and watch some, you know, I think that may be the best like metaphor, you know, it's just be like, you'd be watching the Olympics and something would come on and you just didn't turn the channel and you'd be like, you learned something brand new that you didn't even care about, but now you like it, you know, because you got exposed to it and you took a, you know, you took a chance. You wasted, you know, 30 minutes to learn, you know, to see someone diving off, you know, or whatever, doing, you know, doing something really weird, you know, at the Olympics that, you know, might be done. You know, and it's all spectacular, but I think that we're so transactional in nature. And I find that, you know, I think the interesting thing about your walk that reminds me also of what I read in Granny D's book is how people couldn't get out of the loop. You know, they couldn't join you for a week and then forget about you. And this is the thing to me that you know, what's missing, but it's also out there. And if we can only figure out the art of making that happen more and more, as in getting people so stoked or just having whatever it is, I don't know. We don't put it there. You know what I mean? It's kind of just there. And not at every action, but that action going, that just kind of captures people's imagination. Like, what would be the difference between your walk across the United States and what happened at Dominion? Or would you get the same buy-in or expect at least some buy-in in each one?
Could you ask that last question a little bit different? I had an answer, but then it changed.
From outsiders, I'm saying, you know, you walk across the country, nobody could, you know, and same thing with Granny D. People, there was like 2,800 people there when she finished, you know, and they were from all across the country. And people just, once they came and helped her and drove the van and, you know, that she slept in at night and, or people that gave her a room or something like that, like they just all wanted to keep track of her, you know, and they wanted to, they were all in for it and they liked it. And like you said, there were people who came to your march. And then they would rejoin you at some path. It seems like something that happens with that, you know, that kind of effort. And then you get, like, some of these actions now that are less, that are more sporadic and more transactional in nature, sort of. I mean, you have people coming back, like Ted Glick and Art Tandrup. I mean, people who are hanging there for the long term. But how do we get that buy-in and get people to be less transactional in nature and be more, like, you know, compelled by whatever it is we're doing.
Sure. Well, that is a great question. I understand now. And honestly, for at least the march that I was on, we had that to a certain degree, but not to the same degree from what I can understand that Granny D had. We certainly didn't have that number of people at the end in D.C. when we got there. But there are other reasons for that I will not go into on this program.
Right.
But at least for right now, with the group, because right now I do see myself as being a member of multiple groups that I just am enjoying having the fact that they can support one another, have their own specific kind of transactional agendas, but also realize that there are some very strategic things that we need to address. Of those, it could be something as simple as FERC, or it could be something much broader that is sort of, how do we join with Black Lives Matter, which is much broader, and it has far-reaching implications than a regulatory agency. But both of those things are compelling enough for at least the people that I'm involved with that they understand the importance of it. And it's definitely something that we've been evolving together. So for these actions since November 1st, when we did blockade FERC for an entire week, we've been working with one another up until now even. And it's been primarily this core of people that we're just developing that presence. We're being able to make deeper connections with groups in the region to start out with, but then also broadening so it's not just an environmental or an energy or a climate issue. It comes from actually taking the initiative to do it, realizing ongoingly that, you know what, this is not just about energy. This is not just about fossil fuels.
Right.
We have to actually acknowledge why we're here and why we're actually dealing with these power structures of isolation, basically, that we are confronted with that allow energy companies or that allow fossil fuels to continually be extracted from the ground. And anyway, but just to get back to that, it is something that we have to take upon ourselves to do. And I think the background that we have with just building community, even if it's for a purpose, building community so it isn't just about you know, punching a card, you know, clocking in when we come to the coalition meetings. It should be something that we enjoy doing. We should enjoy the people that we're with, and we can do even better work that way.
Yeah, I have a community group that every you come in and you tell them what your hours were, what hours you put in, like every, and it's just like, I don't know, it's just too transactional for me.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I just I don't like that, and I've just started to identify that, and I'm also involved in a transition group here, and you know, people are trying to explain what transition was, and I said, well, you know, it's like people who are imagining, you know, what we're going to be living like, you know, in 5-10 years from now, and it's like we don't know,
we're gonna
not know together. You know, and that's and that we, you know, to try and just prescribe like, oh, we're going to learn about this or we're going to learn about that, you know, solar, it's all connected. And I think that it's, you know, it's definitely important for people to take a more relational community building approach to things. And also, you know, there's things that are just organic. I mean, the areas of the country that have, you know, just a huge, like, organic movements that grew up. I mean, Oakland is one, you know, you can't deny, you know. They've been protesting together for a long, long time, you know, and it shows, you know, when they get together in the streets, it's very obvious. And I'm not surprised that the climate march, you know, was as big as it was now. And they know each other and, you know, and they look out for each other. And I think that there is, like, this drift that it's organic. You can't control these things. You know what I mean? It's just like, but you can also put the brakes on them, I think, by not focusing on the relational part is what I'm saying. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Yes, very much so. I do think that developing that culture basically, of community, makes it so that when there's an opportunity to apply pressure to a huge degree, which in this case, I would say that part of it could be related to New Yorkers Against Fracking, among other groups, banning fracking in the state, as well as the kind of cascade of different countries around the world banning fracking. It seemed like a perfect time to apply that direct pressure. And at least at this point now, it's very clearly known, at least in the state of California, that fracking is going to be contested to a huge degree, which is great. It was just wonderful to see that going on. I wish I could have been there for it. But again, we're all fighting for the same things. But
well, you were there. Like I was there watching you guys cross the finish line thanks to John Zangas. I mean, definitely. I mean, I do a lot of I do a lot of my being there, you know, through live stream, which everybody knows that if they listen to the show, because I want to be there. It's important to me to be there, you know, when these things are happening. And even when you go back to even Black Lives Matter, I mean, I saw the tweets by Three Pharaoh, you know, and I was just like, what? And somehow I was drawn to it myself. You know, when I saw these tweets by this guy, I was like, he just tweeted it so eloquently about what had happened to Mike Brown. But if you think about Black Lives Matter, I mean, it was chance, you know. I mean, how many people have been gunned down and then nobody just stood there? And I told people on a program a while ago, you know, I think it was on Punk Boy's show, I just said, you know, the reason that happened is because people cared, you know, and that's the only reason that happened. If people didn't care, you know, and then they continued to care as they became threatened and, you know, just the whole thing, the police made more and more of a mockery out of it, you know, as the day wore on, you know, bringing out dogs and stuff like that. And they did. And if they hadn't laid in the street for 4.5 hours, you know, I don't think we would have even had Black Lives Matter. And that's why I think it's so interesting to know that, you know, kind of these things happen sort of on their own. But they also happen because of the humanity. You know, when people's humanity is called upon and it surfaces and something happens, like a spark, I guess. You know what I mean? It's like a spark happens.
Yeah.
And the spark happened there, and you don't know where the spark's going to happen. You know,
nope.
You just never know. And it's like you could go to a million things and like, well, there wasn't a spark there. Why not? We did everything. We tried so hard. And it's just like, well, maybe we didn't care enough, you know. And I don't know. That's just kind of my thoughts, you know, from where I am. And I'm trying to get more involved locally myself, too, because it's, you know, but I need gas money to do that. So which is
sure,
really
sure.
sad. I mean, it's really sad, but I got to go a few miles away from where I am to get involved, but I'm starting to be able to do that. And it's making a big difference for me, I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next for you? Now, you are actually in another city that was just incredible during the Occupy movement, Philadelphia, and just as incredible,
oh,
period.
Oh, Philly, yeah.
You mean, Philly,
oh, gosh, I'm...
if I could move, I would move to Philly, I swear to God, I would.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's fabulous. So what's I know you can't be specific about several things, but what's next
sure.
for Jimmy Betts, and where should people look for you going forward here?
Well, actually, let me give a little shout out about Philly too. There's yet another energy project and corporate backing and government recommendation for Philadelphia to become a new major energy hub, which would include things like the Bakken oil, which would include plenty of fracked gas, which would also include, by extension, possibly a liquid natural gas exports like the one down in Lesby, Maryland at Cove Point. And right now there's a meeting on the 15th with coalitions coming together to talk about how they're going to make sure that doesn't happen. So nothing is a done deal. Even if they say it's a done deal, nothing is a done deal. If we can say no, we're going to be able to still have an opportunity to actually get these things out of communities. The other group that I've been able to connect with is called Edge Philly. So EDGE, Edge Philly.
Okay.
And the acronym is double meaning. We had a great fundraiser that I was just a supporter for, but they're basically a group of artists and activists who fight to end dirty gas exploitation by encouraging the development of the green economy. So EDGE is used twice, two different meanings for the same acronym. So, but they're also a group that should be supported because the artist community across the country becoming more engaged in activism, because essentially that is, again, sort of historically a logical connection, but it's something that isn't being done as broadly anymore that I can see. So trying to get that artist influence back into social change movements is so critical, whether it's performance art, music, poetry, non-traditional, whatever. We need to be able to encourage that development. It creates that media spectacle as well that is so necessary to get people's attention.
Right.
In kind of a corporate media desert is what it seems like.
Well, it also communicates the message. I mean, people don't have time to listen to shows like this or, you know, things. They really don't. Talk has become pretty cheap, you know, in a way. And that's why I do long form, because people say, well, you're going to talk for an hour? I'm like, yeah. We're going to talk for an hour, because we got to talk for an hour to get to the nut. You know, we got to get there. We got to get to the what we're trying to talk about. We won't find it in the first 20 minutes. There's no way.
Sure.
So, you know, I think that the art is the thing that really communicates things directly, instantly, and, you know, from head to heart, you know, as opposed to just head, you know, and like so important. But let's just go a little longer here, because I do want to talk about that. Where did the art go? Like, what happened? Like, I mean, there's still art, but it seems like you're right. You know, I mean, we still have Illuminator. We still have the puppets up in New York and the Light Brigades, which are awesome. The Light Brigades are probably, you know, I mean, what a thing that just proliferated and went everywhere. And then, you know, but what about the art? What happened?
Well, I wouldn't be the best person to answer that question. I can just kind of see where, you know, where is our modern day Bob Dylan? Where is our Pete Seeger? Where are musicians that can create and set the tone for the revolution, the movement? But at the same time, I kind of see it as though we're still in a ripening process. Even though we may have somebody like that, we may not have the ability to support them or at least have that message ring clearly enough, because we're so disjointed in how we're approaching justice movements. It's either my movement or nobody else's. And I think until we kind of address those issues, we're going to have kind of a hit or miss factor going on there. But in terms of why artistry in general, why those more expressive works aren't as integrated, I almost want to say it could just be simple economics. I don't know if it is something where in the past artists have been able to make it on a little bit less, but it seems like any artist friends that I have are constantly struggling with having some sort of full-time job or not being able to engage in their art anymore. And I've known, I tend to connect with a lot of artists more often than not. And it seems like those most radical of the artists are the only ones who do anything related to social justice. Even if they mean well, they may not have the capacity or ability to do it because of their economic situation or other factors. So I really don't have an answer, but I want to find some sort of solution that engages artists much more broadly. There is a proposal on the table, too, specifically about getting artists involved in sort of direct actions that are on a national scale, too, which I won't talk about now, but certainly have someone contact me to discuss some of these ideas.
Yeah. Well, it'd be nice to have some kind of artist collective that was funded by some kind of Kickstarter or something. You know, some way to just make that possible, but, you know, just to blow that up some way, somehow. I know I think about it a lot, but, you know, you look at it and, you know, we've got, you know, God bless them, but seriously, you know, we got Neil Young and Willie Nelson. I mean, these people are back from my day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like they don't speak to the younger generation. And there's, you know, we've had some in Black Lives Matter, you know, we have Tef Poe and Jaziri X. And they're great. I mean, they're phenomenal, you know, artists. And, you know, some of it's accessible to, you know, I wouldn't say it may not be as broadly accessible type thing. But, you know, it's good that it's there because it is accessible at least to groups that, you know, haven't even, you know, been standing up and or haven't been able to put out there. And, you know, Immortal Technique, things like that. I mean, those are the only people that I could think of, you know, right now that are addressing it. But again, we talked about it with Aaron Califato, and he said, you know, the people just basically, they build a brand, you know, if they become successful, they can't risk it, you know, like coming out being like Willie Nelson, he could be for anything and it doesn't really matter because he ain't gonna lose anything, you know, he doesn't care anyway. And, you know, Neil Young, same deal, sort of. I mean, I don't know, maybe Willie's, you know, I don't know. I think he'll be all right no matter what happens. But, you know, God bless those guys for coming out. But I really look to, and Daryl Hannah and, you know, Mark Ruffalo. I mean, we've got a few people coming out, but it would just be so nice to just see people peel off and say, you know what, this is so important. You know, I've got to do this. And it doesn't have to be from, like, my generation. It could be somewhere coming from the bottom up or somewhere. I don't know. But I think it's still part of the denial. In a way. Do you?
Sure. Well, I think bringing folks up from any position, especially the ones that may not be the most privileged traditionally, is so essential. So it's going to be a matter of actually championing who is the person, who is a person, who are the people that are better representing all of us. And it's not going to be about corporate media saying, oh, this is the person, because if corporate media had its way, we'd just be watching celebrities and reality television all day long, which is pretty much their bend, keeps us placated. But for us, developing people's media, which I'm loving, I'm so glad that I was able to get in touch with John Zong, or rather he got in touch with me, because that type of movement in local communities, it's going to help change and turn the tide for media justice, because one of the reasons why a lot of this doesn't get traction is because people are basically corralled into not knowing what is really going on and what the issues are, what people are fighting for, and letting people know that, in fact, yes, this fight is not something that you need to do alone. There are already people who want to meet you and want to engage in this well. So.
Right. Well, that's a function of, you know, being able to have whatever opinion. You know, I think freedom of speech is like the biggest, best form of oppression there is, because basically everybody's allowed. I figured this out in college, and people told me I was bad and I was a communist. But I said, if everybody can have their own opinion, then nobody can have nobody can agree on anything. And I saw that, like, this was like 30 years ago, you know, and I had a German poetry teacher tell me I had no idea what I was talking about. And, you know, perhaps I didn't, but it'd be nice to have, you know, that kind of, I would just like people to maybe divorce themselves from things like the Grammys. Like, I can't believe activists watch the Grammys. It blows my mind. I'm like, why are we buying into, you know, mainstays of empire, you know, and trying to get recognized. I lose my mind. But, you know, God bless everybody who likes it, and I understand why you do, and we're just on different wavelengths. But I don't see buying into awards of any kind. I think we should be way more collective and way more supportive of each other, you know, here at the bottom, as opposed to wondering what, you know, some rich person is going to get some stupid award.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, who
and I
cares?
Don't say that. I don't say that on Twitter because I would probably lose all my fans, but my fans, haha. I don't have a huge social media presence, but I know I'm like, that was a joke, but I mean, because I don't have fans. I mean, I just have people. I don't know half my people who follow me on Twitter, but it doesn't really matter. I'm just saying it's just, I think we should pay more attention to each other and stay low, like be at the base here, you know, instead of, I don't know, but it's just, we're trained. And I think that's part of the blindness too, is like how bought into you are you into the existing structure? You know, and you know, the existing social infrastructure and empire infrastructure. Like, check your. I mean, I'm not saying I knew this overnight, but you know, and you. It sounds like you're saying the same thing. Like, you know, you check yourself along the way and say, hey, you know, like, is this? Should I be doing this, or should I be feeling this, or where's? You know, what? Why am I feeling this?
Yeah. I think the introspection that anybody who's kind of awakening goes through, it's extremely difficult because it's generally counter to everything around you. So the Grammys is a great example, or the Super Bowl is another example. Anything that requires corporate dollar backing and some sort of anything related to television at this point, honestly, tends to fall in that category for me.
My TV went out the window, like, I think 6 or 7 years ago. I don't even remember how long, but I haven't had one. And that changed a lot for me. But it was a hard thing to do. It was a hard thing to do. But then I jumped onto Facebook and wasted several years on Facebook. But I mean, but you know, that was also a learning experience and getting in with what was going on with Occupy and all the rest of that stuff. But, you know, in the end, you know, it if you keep winnowing and keep checking, you know, you can get to that point where it's more about something different and being unpopular, but still being, I mean, I'm going to say I'm not out there with these, I'm way more upfront on my show than I am on social media, and I think that's natural. I don't think it's weird, but anyway, so anybody wants to take me to the mat on those things, write in. We're definitely willing to hear from you about that. But so anyway, Jimmy, we went a little long today, but that's all right. I don't mind doing that. People, if they want to find you, I have your Facebook and your Twitter, which is at JIMSENG. You also have a blog. What's the name of your blog?
It's called The Mountain Path.
Okay.
Just The Mountain Path is, I guess, the title of it. And it's definitely something that I need to update at this point.
Well, that's all right. But, I haven't linked something that I said was your blog, and it has a lot of information about what you're doing. It's all in the promo, so if anybody wants to check that out, that's great. And we certainly thank you for spending time with us today, and you're certainly welcome to come back on the show. And I'm actually giving a challenge to all my guests right now, is to actually send me a name for a guest that someone else that would be a good guest on the show, if you think that was fun and they might want to come on. So, and you don't have to do it now, but I want to put that challenge out to you, because you guys know all the interesting people, so you might as well send them to me, right? Sound good?
Sounds good.
We still got you there? I think I lost you there for a second.
Yep.
All right, well, we are going to turn out here with Be the Change from Earth Guardians and say goodbye to Jimmy. Have a great day in Philly, man, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
All right, thank you, Annie. Be well.
Right, take care. Bye-bye. You
appreciate
too.
It.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. All right. Jimmy Betts. That was a great interview. Thanks to John Zangas for recommending Jimmy to come on the show. I hope everybody got something out of that. That was actually a really good conversation, I think. Hopefully I wasn't waxing too much prolific, but it's my show. I'm just kidding. All right. We got a bunch of stuff coming up for you guys. The only thing on the docket right now is Beth Foster from Mercy Junction Justice and Peace Center on Thursday, but lots of other things in the pipeline. Please enjoy this song, Be the Change, from Earth Guardians on Twitter, Earth Guardians with a Z at the end, and Earth Guardians on Facebook. They're doing amazing stuff. This is the young kids, 14 and 11, Shuteskut and Itzquat Lake. So enjoy this, and we'll see you on Thursday. Open your heart and hear our generation's call. It's time to be the change. Therefore, what you know is right.
It's time to be the change.